So let me also add my thanks to the organizers for the opportunity to be here. Let me apologize that I'm just regaining my voice after a cold some time ago, so it may get out during a half hour or 45 minutes. Also, you know, those of you who either saw my LASIK lectures or were at my systems and control lecture here a couple of months ago, I think you've probably already seen all the slides, but the packaging here is one that follows in the spirit of what Matt already introduced in terms of talking about quantum feedback control, and in particular coherent feedback control of quantum systems, and trying to kind of look a little bit at where that really sits in the big picture of engineering and why this is an interesting thing. And so, you know, when I talk about quantum photonic circuit theory here, Matt already introduced the idea that there are many people in the physics and in quantum information communities who've been thinking very hard about optimal ways to design single devices. There's, I think, not a lot of thought yet about really how you combine individual components into circuits that really function in a robust way. And what I have, you know, the kind of motivation behind a lot of the work that I'll present on the theory and modeling side is to try to come up with an easy and user-friendly and yet rigorously correct way to reason about photonic circuits, where the models are quantum mechanical in the sense that you can use them to talk about quantum information processing devices if that's what you want. But even if what you're interested in is just thinking about ultra-low power classical information processing, but you're worried about or interested in the effects of quantum fluctuations on the performance of such devices, then this kind of modeling is also perfectly appropriate for that. Okay, so as Matt already introduced, I want to start out just with a few slides to motivate why do I have this title. So what does coherent feedback control have to do with circuit theory? So Matt already introduced that in electrical familiar circuit theory, there are many situations in which you want to utilize feedback as a fundamental design tool. Right, so Matt showed a non-inverting amplifier, there's an inverting amplifier, but you get used to the idea that, oh, am I supposed to have a microphone?
Yeah, yes, please.
There are two major reasons why we want to use feedback as a basic design tool in circuits. So one is that real-time feedback allows us to design robustness in a way that's hard to achieve otherwise. So if we just look at this simple example of an inverting amplifier, you know, the thing that's doing all the heavy lifting is the operational amplifier, here just represented by a gain element with gain G. But the problem is that from component to component, you don't exactly know what G is. And furthermore, because of just air currents or temperature changes or other things like that, G is in general going to fluctuate in time. But when you're building an amplifier, you would like to have an exact amplification and so the way that you achieve that is that you use simple but more accurate components, things like precision resistors. So these are things that don't have any gain in of themselves, right? So they don't do the heavy lifting, but they can be made much more accurately so that you can count on their properties to be accurately specified and not to vary in time. And if you do just a very, very simple analysis of how the output voltage V2 is related to the input voltage V1 in this kind of a setup, really what you get, if you include the finite gain of the op-amp is the expression on the top, so V2 is an inverted version of V1 with some overall gain factor. But what you notice there is that as long as G is large, right, you can ignore the R1 plus R2 in the denominator, and so basically you have that the output is related to the input simply by the ratio of the resistances there. And you don't need any exact value for G in order to achieve that, you just need G to be very large. And in fact, as long as G is very large, even if it varies in time, that's not really going to have a major impact on what the overall of the feedback network is. And that's just the very simple idea of how you gain robustness to real-time feedback. And it's one that I'd like to show more of a kind of coherent generalization of in a few slides. The other reason why we like to use feedback, again, Matt already alluded to this, is that you can use real-time feedback to synthesize new kinds of dynamics. Right, so in this example of the set-reset latch that Matt referred to, you know, this is a NAND gate. That's a NAND gate. And if you think about what a NAND gate is, it's a map, right? I mean, in the idealized operation of a NAND gate, you have signals present at the inputs. That determines the signal at the output. But there's no internal notion of state for something like a NAND gate. But if you take two such NAND gates and interconnect them in a sort of a figure-eight feedback loop, you actually make something that has a bit of memory in it, right? And that an arrangement like this, if you keep both of these inputs high, this is a bistable system which can either hold a 0, 1, or 1, 0. And then you can set the internal state of the flash by pulling one of these signals down and then restoring to the hold condition. But basically what feedback does here is it takes two elements that in and of themselves have no memory, but you make a very simple little feedback network that now actually has memory. And so you're synthesizing new kinds of dynamics through the use of feedback. And that's another thing that I want to revisit in this more kind of a coherent sort of setting in a few slides. So electrical circuits, you know, I think in this day and age, we're all used to looking at these optical images of semiconductor wafers that have been patterned using lithography. Most of the time when you see those images, you're looking at electrical circuits which have been patterned onto a wafer of silicon. But now increasingly you'll see that semiconductor companies are trying to develop that kind of processing capability, not to make electrical circuits, but actually to make photonic circuits. So this is an image of something that you can download from the IBM research website. You know, right now it's not particularly fine-grained lithography, but what this is meant to show is that industry is developing the capability to pattern photonic circuits with very high degree of complexity. You know, I think it'll be a while before that really gets down to the kind of nanometer scales that people are ultimately interested in, but this is a direction that the industry is very interested in moving in. And so why is it interested in that? Another slide that you can download from the IBM research website, this is actually a PowerPoint chart taken from a plenary talk that Yuri Vlasov gave at Clio last year. And kind of what it is, essentially an artist's rendition of how they are imagining photonic layers of information processing may be integrated into Pentium-style computer chip architectures on the timescales of, say, a few years from now, and then maybe even thinking kind of a decade from now. And so, if you haven't heard about it otherwise, why do you want photons on your computer chip? Well, there are some kind of ugly things about computer chips where I don't think anybody's actually really interested or too concerned about the speed with which transistors switch. Electronic classical information processing is extremely fast. You can make these devices, you can pattern them extremely densely, but you have major problems in terms of power consumption and heat dissipation, especially as you start to think a few years down the road and the sort of extremely multi-core kinds of chip designs that people are really thinking about. So you have these funny things like, even in the computer chip that's in my laptop, there's a single socket for where the processor goes in. You may remember that, if you think back to, if you opened up desktop computers for a while, say during the 90s and even into the 2000s, you got used to, every couple of years you could pay the same amount of money for a new computer and the performance would double. But otherwise nothing really about the inside would change, because really you're just talking about better chips put into the same socket. Nowadays, when you look at it though, you pay more money for a computer every few years, the performance doesn't really improve that much. But the main thing that you notice is that when you open up the cover, the heat fins or the fan that's on your processor socket, that thing gets bigger and bigger. And so, I think there are architectural reasons, I'm told, why you can't really dissipate more than a couple hundred watts in a computer socket. And so, but even in today's kind of computer chips, half of that power just goes to distributing the clock. Right, because as you're making all the transistors and things smaller, all the wires have to get smaller. So the distances that you have to move your bits get smaller, but what happens faster than that is that the cross-section of your wires goes down. So ohmic losses are going up, and you run into very serious problems with just the amount of energy it takes to move your bit from one transistor to the next transistor. And that's becoming a limiting factor in computer chip design. And when you think about the way that we're trying to get more speed out of a single socket processor these days is by going to a more and more multi-core kind of design, communication from one end of the chip to another is becoming more and more important, more and more important. And so therefore it drives even a company like IBM to think fairly seriously about, well, can you have an optical layer on the chip that allows you to move your bits around at much lower power cost and with much lower heat dissipation, even if you're still just thinking about classical information processing, etc. And so, this kind of artist's rendition of what you might want a decade from now, you see that there's a massively parallelized kind of thing where you sort of have processing elements distributed throughout the chip, your cache memory is also distributed all the way through the chip, but then kind of, your computation might happen locally in an electronic form, but when you need to send information from this part of the chip to the other, somehow that information has to get down into the optical layer, propagate through optical waveguides to get to the other part of the chip, and then read back in. Right, so there's just this kind of blue slab down here for the photonic layer in an envisioned future computer chip architecture. And the question that I think we should really be addressing today in the kind of academic sector is, well, if you really want to take this vision, you kind of have the idea that, well, a lot of what this layer is waveguides and things, but it's not just going to be moving bits around. right? You're going to want to do some amount of logic to do things like switching, because you're going to have to worry about things like cache coherence. So there's going to be some amount of processing that goes down in an optical layer. So apparently you're talking seriously about making a very complex optical information processing layer in a computer chip like that. And this has to operate with an extremely high degree of power efficiency, and it also has to be pretty fast. And you know, the kinds of parameters that a serious computer architect will throw at you is you would like to have switching energies that are sort of petajoule in scale, and you would like to have switching times that are sort of picosecond in scale. And so picosecond is a very, it's a short time compared to what we're used to for coherence times in the world of quantum optics. And in attajoule, you know, if we're talking near infrared photons, that's like 5 to 10 photons. So even if you don't care a lick about quantum information processing, this kind of picture gives you a very good reason to want to make quantum optical models of complicated classical information processing circuits. And you have a reason to think that quantum fluctuations are going to be an important driver or limiting factor in the kind of performance you can get in those layers. So that's kind of where I'm trying to go with this, is to understand, all right, so how should we now, even at a very high level, how should we start to think about those sorts of systems where you want to have a large number of photonic components connected together in a complex circuit kind of fashion, and we want to have a model at the end of this that correctly accounts for switching nonlinearities on the one hand, but quantum fluctuations on the other. To just give you a very specific feel for, you know, what the device models might look like and how it is that quantum fluctuations enter, let me just take a few steps backwards to the kinds of things that people were thinking about back in the 80s. I always think it's not a coincidence that back in the 80s that was sort of the initial heyday of cavity QED, right? People like Jeff Kimball were first starting to think seriously about optical cavity QED in that day. That was also the time when people were thinking seriously about optical computing in the days before CMOS really took off. But so, you know, these sorts of cavity nonlinear optical devices are sort of a prototype for how you do switching with an optical component. And so, you know, if I just have an optical cavity, so these are two mirrors, you think of this as making a resonator, and we introduce in there some sort of a nonlinear optical element. So in my world, we can think about, say, introducing an ensemble of cesium atoms into this cavity, and the nonlinear response of those atoms to the intercavity field gives me some kind of effective nonlinearity. Now, if I just do sort of a mean field analysis for what's going on there, right, so I just worry about the mean values and forget about the quantum fluctuations, I can calculate, you know, what are the equilibrium states of such a system, let's say, as a function of the power of the driving light that comes in to drive the cavity. So that's the input signal. So if you do that kind of a mean field calculation, you'll find that if this axis is the input power, then this axis might be the output power. And you find that there will be regimes in which the output power has multiple stable points over a given range of inputs. Right, so the idea of this is that if I start with a very low input power and kind of sweep it up, I'll find that hardly any power comes through the device, and then in fact I can continue coming into this regime. Once I hit this upper turning point, however, the local equilibrium point disappears, so suddenly the output power will switch with a very sharp threshold to something on this higher branch. Now, if I were to sweep the input power back down, I would stay on this higher branch through the bisable region until I hit the lower switching point, and I would go back down. And this is an unstable equilibrium point that exists between the two stable branches. So you get the idea of how this thing can now be used as something like a latch, right? So if I have a bias field that just holds the sort of mean input power here, then depending on if I temporarily blip that down or up, right, I can set the output of this device to either be low or high. But then as long as that bias field is there, it's going to kind of remember that latch given. So variations on this kind of idea have been thought about for ages in terms of how you might do optical information processing. Now, if we get into this limit, though, where we really want to think about things being very fast, then our devices should be very small. If you want to have these attajoule scale kind of switching energy scales, then you might think about something where there's actually not an ensemble of atoms in there in a macroscopic cavity, but we're really thinking about some sort of nanophotonic resonator, and the nonlinearity is provided by something like a quantum dot or an atom, or, you know, some sort of a very highly nonlinear bulk medium. Then, you know, if you calculate the mean field dynamics, you'd get exactly the same picture. The difference is, you know, when things are very macroscopic and high energy, if you ask, well, you know, this is an optical field, so it's got a mean value, but it also has some quantum fluctuations, how big are those quantum fluctuations on the scale of the nonlinearities? So in the macroscopic world, you know, if m is the number of, is a characteristic number of photons inside the cavity, then the quantum fluctuations are at scale squared of m. And in the world of the 1980s, this number might be 10 to the 8, right? So fractionally, this represents 10 to the minus 4 fluctuations due to the quantum stuff. And so you can pretty much just get away with ignoring that. But if we're talking about attajoule and say m is like 10, right, then square root of 10 is a big number. So now you're suddenly talking about 30 or 40% quantum fluctuations, and you can no longer really ignore that. And you might really worry that those sorts of quantum fluctuations are just going to completely destroy this picture of bistability when we really try to go into something like a single atom or ultra low power or nanoscale sort of regime. And of course, there have been, you know, a lot of very nice theoretical papers written about this kind of thing over the years. We recently did a simple cavity QED type of experiment to explore that. There's a lot of statistical analysis into really convincing ourselves that we actually understand what's going on with that. But the basic idea of the experiment is just that I have a kind of, you know, micro cavity which gives me strong couplings, individual cesium atoms. We take a cold cloud of cesium atoms, we drop them through in this sort of, you know, the style that we established back in Jeff Kimball's group back in the 1990s. You get individual atoms falling through the cavity one at a time, and during the periods where you have an atom in there, you can investigate the optical input-output properties of the cavity. So here's an example of a single theta trace, so this is just, you know, what you would see on an oscilloscope, basically if you just put a photodetector on the output field from this cavity. This is drawn with very high bandwidth. So this axis is time, the units there are microseconds, so that's 0 to 20 microseconds. And what's going on in this trace is that for the first part of it, you don't have an atom in the cavity yet, but then you detect that you have an atom in the cavity, and so you turn on a driving field. And the power of that driving field is meant to be in the middle of the bistable region, according to a mean field kind of calculation. And so semi-classically, what you would expect is that the output should then converge to either the lower bistable value or the higher bistable value, and it should just sit there. But quantum mechanically, you imagine that there might be some fluctuations. So if you look at this region of the data trace, we're just looking at the power, and in fact, if you histogram the output power that's coming through as a function of time, you get these blue things here, where you have a very clearly bimodal kind of two Gaussian statistical distribution for the power that comes out. And you can establish by comparisons with theory, so the bars in the histogram are the data, the smooth blue curve is a theoretical calculation with just a few calibrated parameters in it. What you really find is that, you know, this sort of jumping from this kind of level to that sort of level, right? You have sort of a mean level here with some vacuum fluctuations around it. You have a different mean level here with some vacuum fluctuations around it. And what's happening is that you're getting a kind of quantum switching between those low and high values of the output that the latch is supposed to hold. Yeah, so that sounds not good, right? It sounds like the quantum fluctuations really just destroy this picture of bistability. However, you know, in a sense, this is all a question of time scales, right? The fact that we actually resolve a bi-Gaussian kind of distribution here says something like, well, you know, you're not just completely smearing out this bistable structure. You do sort of sit metastably on one point and then switch rapidly down to the other, sit there metastably and then switch back, right? You know, there are some time scales that you can maybe play with. And to pull that out, one of the things we did was to just actually try to map out this hysteresis loop. Right, so you take the power that's going into the cavity, you sweep it up and down, and if you sweep that up and down very slowly, right, then what you see is what's drawn on this plot here. And let me not take the time to explain what all of these different things are, but just the red data points sort of show you what's happening on the up sweep, the blue data points show you what's happening on the down sweep. And so in a completely mean field limit, you would expect this to look like this, and you would open up a big hysteresis loop. But if you do that sweeping slowly, that hysteresis loop kind of collapses. That's because while you're in the bistable region, the actual power is just randomly jumping up and down between the two different points. However, you can find a region of time scales where you go slowly enough that you're not violating some kind of basic adiabaticity with respect to the cavity decay rate, but you're going fast enough that much of the time you don't have one of these quantum jumps while you're traversing the bistable region. And so if you sweep quickly enough, you actually do manage to open up sort of a kinetic hysteresis loop. And so you see the fact that hysteresis loop and the bistability is really still there. Right? It's just that on some time scale, the quantum fluctuations sit in and sort of spoil a mean field picture, and that's something that you have to deal with. But, you know, in a certain sense, if you were doing things very rapidly, then you would have some residual quantum switching rate, which would be like a background noise process. But the essential features of the bistability are really still there. You just have to work a little bit harder to actually make use of those. And so I forgot to point out that, you know, in these experiments, you know, the difference between these two logical states is really about 9 photons. Right? So you really are down in this adagial regime for looking at bistability. And this is just, maybe the main thing to take away from this is that we go to look at something like observed bistability in this really adagial 10 photon kind of energy regime. but the kinds of models that we have in quantum optics for analyzing a single device like this, they're really very accurate. Right, so there's no unknown physics or anything weird like that, at least in atomic physics implementation of this sort of thing. We understand how the individual device works, right? The questions that are going to come up are just sort of like, well, how do you know? Can I design circuits with these sorts of components that actually still allow me to do something something interesting? So, you know, with that introduction, let me skip ahead to some kind of theoretical sort of work now. And so, everything that I'm showing here, even though it's noisy, these are not just the results of numerical simulations, but using a model which is very much inspired by the kinds of experiments that we did a few years ago. So here, a very similar sort of thing. What I'm going to think about is just a ring resonator. So the three mirrors arranged in a triangle. This is something that I can think about as an optical cavity again. And rather than having an atom as the source of my nonlinearity, let me just imagine that this resonator includes some sort of a Kerr nonlinear medium that gives me sort of a chi-3 nonlinearity. And that gives rise to a different kind of optical isolability, but it's still basically the same idea. If this axis on this plot is input power, the vertical axis is then output power, there's some range of input powers for which the output is bistable. And I can again imagine situations where, say, that beta input that drives the cavity, I could hold it at some biasing point, which is in the middle of this bistable region, and this is something where I might expect this, and I hope that I could use this thing as a sort of a latch. But if I, you know, put parameters into this kind of a model where the, you know, the lower and upper logical states are just separated by something like 10 photons, and then I go in and do, say, a quantum trajectory simulation of what the output would actually look like, then even for a fixed value of the bias field, the output field would look something like this, where, you know, it would transiently hold the lower logical state, but then jump to the higher logical state, and then jump back down. And so, you know, on some long time scale, you see that there would be this same kind of spontaneous switching between the logical low and the logical high. Right, so just, you know, bringing back in the same qualitative kind of stuff that we were studying in the previous experiment. So, you know, something you see from this, you know, if you look at the sharpness of these jumps, clearly this time scale on which the switching happens is very long compared to the actual decay rate of the cavity. So you could imagine still using this kind of a device in a circuit and using it as a latch, you would simply have to accept that on some time scale you'll get spontaneous switching as kind of a noise process. But, you know, thinking back to this whole idea of the op-amp and the idea of the inverting amplifier and trying to use feedback to improve the performance of otherwise, say, noisy kinds of devices, you can ask, is there a sort of a feedback loop that I could try to implement that would not change the energy scale on which this device was operating, but that would somehow ameliorate the effects of these sorts of quantum fluctuation-induced noise switching processes? And so that's the spirit of a calculation that's in an applied physics letter a year and a half ago or so. And so the idea of that is just to note that if this is my ring resonator that's behaving basically as a latch like that, a thing that I could imagine doing is taking some of the field that leaks out of this mirror, I do something to it, right? So I run it through a controller, and then I let that field come back into the original one. And so kind of what I want from that, so this is sort of like the impedance network that I wrap around this feedback around an op-amp. But now these are quantum optical components, and you know the signal that's traveling around the feedback loop is not an electrical signal, but now it's optical fields. And so the basic insight of how this works is if I ignore this business for a second and just say that, well, you know, I've got some light leaking out here, maybe it just has a phase shift and then it comes back. What does that do in terms of a simple, this would be like a proportional coherent controller? So the thing that you can see is that, you know, if these mirrors are assumed to have the same leakiness, I'm just going to do that as an illustration. Then you have some field leaking out here. You have basically the same field leaking out there. They have a fixed phase relation to one another. So you can imagine just sort of thinking of this as closing an interferometer, where if you bring this field back around and you bring it here, mostly what that field will do is bounce off of that. You coherently combine with the field that was leaking out anyway. If I arrange for that to be a completely destructive interference by choosing this phase correctly, then it basically shut off this output port, and I've shut off that output port at the same time. So what I will have done is actually increase the effective Q factor, decrease the effective decay rate of this cavity, and that'll have some effect on the dynamics. On the other hand, if I arrange for this to be a constructive interference, then by the magic of amplitudes and powers, I actually suck power out of this ring resonator a factor of 2 faster than it would have otherwise happened, or 4 faster than it otherwise would have happened, and so I effectively lower the quality factor of this resonator. And so now you get the idea of what you might want to do is, observing this as the open loop dynamics of this switching element, if I could make the phase shift around the feedback loop, if I could make that nonlinear, right? So if I can make the phase with, that the feedback beam picks up be a function of its power, and then I might like to try to arrange for that phase to be one that stabilizes the lower logical state when there's a small amount of power coming around the feedback loop, and then stabilizes the higher logical state when there's a higher amount of power coming around the feedback loop, then I will have implemented a controller that in some way reduces the rate of spontaneous switching. And so, you know, I don't claim that the design that I came up with is optimized in any way. I just, you know, did a little bit of hunting around in parameter space to try to find things. But basically, if you just make this guy another Kerr nonlinear cavity, and so you just have, this is a Kerr nonlinear cavity that acts as a switch, this is a Kerr nonlinear cavity that acts as a controller, and you imagine having this sort of a coherent feedback loop, you know, you can, in fact, suppress the rate of quantum switch of quantum fluctuation selecting and switching by a factor of 2 or 3. Or, you know, if you arrange for the phase here to be exactly wrong, you can increase it by a factor of 2 or 3. So it's just sort of a proof of principle kind of idea that by thinking about these photonic elements and thinking about simple little circuit motifs involving real-time feedback, but where that feedback is all happening at the sort of the level of the optical fields themselves, you can, you know, start to do things that remind you of what you do at a very basic level in electrical circuit design, the kinds of things that Matt was already alluding to in his previous talk. Machinery of the, you know, so in building models, right, so if I have component models for what this thing is and what that thing is, and I don't want to come up with a rigorous overall model for how the feedback loop behaves, really this is using this SLH formalism that John and Matt have very nicely laid out for us. And, you know, it's not difficult to use, and especially at the level of just connecting two components there, it's not a hard thing to do by hand. You know, I would actually submit that it's, you know, once you know how to use the formalism, it's not harder to do that calculation than it would have been to do all of this stuff classically. But if we want to take seriously the idea that we eventually want to get to very complicated sort of circuits, then really you would like some sort of computer-aided paradigm for taking given component models from a library, drawing very complicated circuits, and you would like the computer to do all the algebra for you to actually derive rigorously some overall model for how you should describe the closed loop operation of that circuit. And you would really like this to be a continuous time master equation level kind of model that really has all of the bumps and wiggles in it, into which you can also insert various kinds of noise models that you might be interested in. And so there's a software development project that we've been undertaking for some time. Let me just mention so they don't forget about it. So we've been working on the development of this for some time. There's now a first public release of this software. And so the URL that you can go to is mabuchilab.github.com/qnet. If you just Google search for Mabuchi QNet, I think you should land on this place. But you know, from this webpage, you can download all of the code that you need. And so some of it is our own code. Some of it is open source software from other people. And so all the pointers, all that kind of stuff, and installation instructions, and a basic tutorial can all be found on this QNet webpage. So what does this software do? So the basic way that it works is take your favorite present-day electrical engineering computer package for drawing electrical circuits. So the one that we recommend is something called GScan because it's open source and it's free. And this is a tool that electrical engineers use all the time to lay out electrical circuits. And what we do is we define a library of components that are not electrical components, but they're photonic components. And so you'll have symbols for each of them. And the symbols will have a certain number of input-output ports. And so, for example, here's a layout of something like an SR set reset NAND latch that Matt and I have each both talked about now. But actually, if you push in and say, what does this symbol actually represent? It's an encapsulation of another optical network where you have some Kerr nonlinear cavity, a bunch of beams, so there's some bias beams, so some, you know, interferometer kind of network. But you represent all of that in various input-output ports by symbol. And so in the software, you just use your mouse, you pick out the NAND symbol from your library of component symbols, you place it down on the grid, and then you take your, and maybe you put down another one, and then you just take your mouse and you click on the ends of things to connect the different ports together, and then you wire up your circuit in that way. Right, so underneath the hood, what you're imagining is that each one of these symbols represents a sort of sub-network of components whose inputs and outputs are connected, and then you can, with your mouse, add, you know, additional connection to things. And then when you're done, you just ask the GScan software to save the netlist in a standard format called VHDL. So It's a BHDL completely industry standard format for describing the connection topology of electrical circuits. You use exactly the same format to simply store the connection topology of a photonic circuit. And so what BHDL looks like is it's something like this. And, you know, it kind of looks like C code, but it's not. We have the open source version of all this software that you can download from QNET. It's based on BHDL as the representation format for what the NetMOS looks like. We have another format which is based on Modelica. The reason being that Modelica interfaces very nasty with Mathematica, but that makes it not really open source and not completely free. If you're interested in knowing about the Mathematica and Modelica version of all this, you can just send us an email. But this VHDL stuff is all completely open source and free. So anyway, so the program will save this thing. And then for the VHDL side, a student named Nicholas Sivak has written many thousands of lines of code, which will go through and basically compile the VHDL description of the circuit, bring in the actual component models from the library, and end up spitting out a master equation type description of the circuit model. So here, for example, is something where, you know, those previous slides are actually about an AND latch. If you do something, here's a model which I think Josh maybe showed something like this earlier in the week. If you use GSCAM and the right components to lay this circuit down, where each one of these components is some cavity QED type component, and then these connections are basically just envisioned as some sort of single mode waveguides that connect the inputs to the outputs. This is now a circuit model where, without any sort of external clocking or control, if you just provide this thing with some optical power, so you shine some weak coherence aids into certain optical input ports, and where, you know, the exact amplitude of those things doesn't matter, they can fluctuate a little bit with time, you just need to respect a certain hierarchy of some parameters being a larger than others, then make this layout, it's an autonomous circuit. When you compile it through the whole thing, you get the master equation that's shown here. And so that's a circuit that will autonomously implement a sort of continuous time version of the bit flip error correcting code. And there's a larger version of that that'll do the 9-bit code, or 7-bit code, or 5-bit code, or what have you. Okay? And so this is, again, to reemphasize this idea that these quantum photonic circuit models that we're coming up with, you can either work with those in the world where we're interested in classical information processing, but we want to understand the impact of quantum fluctuations in the ultra-low power limit, or you can go all the way over to a quantum information processing sort of paradigm. And then what it's really interesting for is in terms of trying to understand completely autonomous versions of these things. You know, so I was curious, it was funny to see Matt put up basically the same slide. Right? And the complaint that I was making is in the quantum computing community, when you say quantum circuit diagram, right, you always have something like that in mind. But that's not really a circuit diagram. That's a graphical pseudocode that represents an algorithm. Because it says that first you do this, and then you do that, and then you do that. But there's no specification of what's doing those things, right? That's just, those are somehow, that's the order in which you're supposed to implement certain kinds of operations. And there's no physical correlate of any of the symbols that's written there. Now, if you compare that with the kind of classical analog electronics kind of diagram that Matt also showed, this is a circuit diagram in the sense that that's a physical component, that's a physical component. These lines just represent, I just take a pin here and I make a conductive connection to that pin there. Right? And in the photonic world, kind of what that would be like is, this is quasi-imaginary, but you know, here's a real electromicrograph taken from a paper from Elena Butchkovich's group, and you know, kind of there's a device here, there's a device here, there's a device there, these waveguides in the photonic crystal are winding together. And so that's a circuit diagram in the same way that's a circuit diagram. And the idea is that this kind of circuit diagram is really what's represented here. Like, these are physical components. These wires tell you what ports to connect to what ports. And then once you've made this thing, right, like in this kind of an electrical circuit, if you make this thing, the assumption is that you don't need to provide it with any external control at all. Right? You just power this thing and it should go and do its thing. And that's exactly the idea of this sort of a circuit, that if you can actually make this layout, then you just have to provide it with optical power, and then it will just do its thing and implement a sort of continuous kind of quantum error correction. And that operation is, in fact, described exactly by this kind of a master equation. So you really have a real-time description of what's going on with that sort of a device. So, you know, I started out in this whole talk sort of talking on the one hand about very grandiose ideas of where hybrid computer architectures are going to be a decade down the line, where we want to talk about, you know, massively complex and integrated sort of photonic circuits, I then, briefly just now talked a little bit about quantum information processing and how these circuit models might be useful there. But the other kind of technology paradigm where I think there's maybe a more closer term niche for really making some of these things useful is in thinking about distributed sensor networks and fiber sensor networks. Right, so this micrograph that I've already shown from Yelena Vukcevic's work, right, this is a zoom-in of a planar photonic crystal circuit. Now, here's another image just taken from a publication from a different one of my colleagues back at Stanford. This is from Olaf Solgaard's group. And here what you have a picture of is this is the end of an optical fiber. You cleave and polish the end of the optical fiber, and they can take planar photonic circuits like this and start just welding them on the end. And so here, I think they were just after something very simple, like an optical temperature sensor. But it gives you the idea that photonic circuits like this can relatively simply be combined with optical fiber technology. And so now you get the idea that, all right, so if this photonic circuit is something that does some interesting information processing, maybe it incorporates some sort of an optical sensor, and you can power it with an extremely low optical power, then this optical fiber could be 100 kilometers long. It could be trailing off the back of a submarine somewhere in the ocean. And if you put, 10 nanowatts of power into one end of the fiber, basically all of that gets here. And that can be enough power to actually drive a circuit with no additional controller power source. It can do something, read its sensor, process the information, and then send that back over that 100 kilometer long fiber with very minimal loss in the signal. And so you see this idea of, making low-power photonic circuits that can be powered purely optically and that are otherwise completely autonomous. It starts to give you these ways of really embedding a certain amount of classical, or I suppose you could even think about quantum information processing, in very remotely distributed parts of the fiber sensor network. And I think that kind of idea is maybe where we can first look at some real applications of these kinds of things. Because, there are some niche applications where fiber sensor networks are important. Fibers are much more tolerant of high temperatures than electrical circuits are, and glass is actually much, much lighter than copper. So in avionics and other applications like that, I think people are very interested in, the whole field of RF photonics. There are a lot of practical interests just in that. Doing things optically can save you size, weight, and power as compared to electrical things. Now notice that speed is not an axis on that diagram. I wouldn't try to argue that speed or overall computational complexity is something that you gain by switching from electronics to photonics. But these other metrics of size, weight, and power, I think there's a lot to actually be gained. And I think for this community, the likes to think about feedback control and quantum mechanics and just the quantum optics community in general, I think that's a very interesting direction to look in terms of really trying to be able to do things that are interesting to us from a fundamental physics point of view, and yet also maybe have some real impact in terms of what people are doing in technology. All right.
Questions and discussion comments?
Yep. So I'm obviously very excited about the prospects of photonics, particularly from an active circuit perspective, but I have to say that the nonlinearities that we've got available to us in the photonics domain feel pretty paltry compared to the electrical options. So what's our future there?
So what do you mean by strong nonlinearity? So if what you're interested in is just making a large nonlinearity in photonics, and if you take it for granted that single photon nonlinearity is probably even actually too strong to make use of, right? Because you would like to represent your information in weak coherent states and not really in single photon states, because you want to have easy robustness to certain amounts of propagation loss. So you seem to start talking about things like, I know I badmouthed quantum dots before, but quantum dots and cavities are nitrogen vacancy centers and cavities. That's the way to get a very strong nonlinearity. But I would say that I fundamentally don't believe in that as a good approach in the long run, because, you can see that the lithography is going to get there, where we're going to have the capability to pattern the passive optical structure of a photonic circuit at a large scale with high complexity. That's going to come. Now, being able to pick and place quantum dots or things like that, put them in the right place in the circuit, and to not have issues with dispersion in the properties of those different quantum dots, I'm not at all convinced that's going to happen. So taking a cue from the lovely people in circuit QED, I think that what we really ought to be looking for in optics is a bulk material property that allows us to do what superconductivity has allowed the microwave people to do in circuit QED. Now, what might that possibly be? You know, just some random musings in terms of, you know, you asked the question, so I'll take it as my excuse to talk about this. You know, when you think about the dosage induction kind of thing, what do? I mean, you take, in the microwave regime, you take an LC oscillator, which is a harmonic oscillator, and we all know that harmonic oscillators are more or less boring from an information perspective. But if you think about that minor or evenly spaced states, if you can introduce a very strong nonlinearity, right, so that you make a very anharmonic kind of oscillator, well, then you have some energy spacing between the 0 and 1 states, and then some very different spacing to the 2. And so you can kind of pull out a 2-state subspace and treat that thing like a qubit. That's the basic idea of what happens in circuit QED. What would the analog of that be in optics? Well, you can imagine, like, say I give myself a very strong chi 3 or chi 2 nonlinearity, I would have the exact analog of that. But then as soon as you start thinking about, well, what kinds of materials would really give you such a strong optical nonlinearity? I mean, they may give you a really strong chi 2 or chi 3, but they're also going to give you very strong absorption, like multiphoton absorption. Now, the question is, does that spoil the party? Maybe, maybe not. So a thing that I have recently become kind of obsessed with is the observation that, well, suppose the only nonlinearity that you have available to you is a very strong absorptive nonlinearity, right? So just imagine that I have some bulk medium, and I'm thinking here of a sheet of something. And if what it gives you is a very, very strong two-photon absorption with a relatively weaker one-photon absorption, then if you take a harmonic oscillator, which to us is just an empty optical cavity, and you couple that to a very strong source of two-photon absorption, you can use all this QSDE limit theorem stuff to prove to yourself that now that optical cavity with a strong two-photon absorber, that thing behaves like a qubit. So if you drive it with a coherent field, it'll do Rabi oscillations. And you can couple it to other qubits like that just by connecting it with waveguides. You know, so what I'm interested in these days when I talk to my materials physics friends is I'm trying to find a magic material that has an extremely strong two-photon absorption with a relatively weak one-photon absorption that you can somehow integrate with with CMOS processes down the line. And it's not impossible to do that. So for example, bilayer graphene is a candidate kind of material. And then this other latter one is not a good one because it pushes you down to the terahertz. But thin film topological insulators also give you the right kind of structure. So we recently put out a paper with some colleagues at Stanford about calculating, you can actually calculate that there are divergences in the two-photon absorption cross-section for thin film bismuth selenide, which unfortunately are in the terahertz, but it's the right kind of idea.
In terms of generating large nonlinearities in optics, what do you think of the idea of pursuing optomechanics and nanophotonic optomechanics? Because there the nonlinearities are mechanical,
yeah,
and they're large.
Yep.
Admittedly, you may have to work at low temperature, but the superconducting guys work at low temperature. So,
I think ultimately, if you talk to computer people, right, they want everything to work not only at temperature, they want it to work at 100 degrees Celsius, because the server room is an incredibly hot environment. But the idea of coupling to other degrees of freedom is certainly a very interesting one. You have to worry about timescales and things, right, because you would like these nonlinearities to be basically instantaneous on the scale of the optical stuff. But, you know, as a source of nonlinearity, it's very interesting.
Well, you get EIT and optical biostability with optomechanics, and they're pretty large.
I think maybe the upshot of this kind of musing is simply that I bet that as long as you have a very strong nonlinearity, whatever kind of nonlinearity that is, and as long as your linear absorption is not too large at the same time, you can probably use any such thing to convert optical resonators into qubits. That's a conjecture.
So all of the kind of feedback that you're describing, including your quantum error correction, is coherent quantum feedback in some sense. So is there a reason that you focus on that versus measurement? And what are the trade-offs that you see in terms of?
I think just, in terms of technology, the idea of not even focusing on whether it's coherent or measurement, but really that you want to make autonomous embedded nanoscale systems, that's the important thing.
Okay.
Right? And so, I would just say that it's just, coherent feedback is a convenient way of doing things that are very similar to things that you might otherwise do with measurement feedback. But now you can sort of represent everything with the same library of parts and, make your autonomous quantum memory, out of things that are all basically qubits. Then you can have a master equation for the whole thing. And if you would think about actually building it, then, as we like to say with the circuit QED guys, you don't need any cables going in and out of the door. It's all just down there.
But do you see any intrinsic trade-off in terms of performance and what you can achieve? I mean, for example, I'm sure the coherent error-correcting autonomous circuit is, it's very similar in its spirit to what Mohan described yesterday in his talk in terms of in that case, it was a Hamiltonian system with an energy gap,
and designed in some sense to be self-error protecting without measurements. And so the question in my mind, what are the trade-offs in those?
Sure, so I mean, it shows the quantum error correction, you know. Jared and Mohan wrote a paper early on, and there was the Doherty Mandelin on paper. You know, so basic idea is how you cast error correction just generally as a continuous time thing with feedback. That certainly is the departure point for any of the stuff that we've done. But really, the win that you get is really, it's the size, weight, and power kind of wins, right? Quantum error correction is an intriguing example of something where the whole point of the stabilizer formalism is to make the error correction process classical. So there's no inherent advantage to doing it coherently as opposed to doing it in a measurement-based way. Right, if you look at our controller, it's a very dissipative controller, right? As it kind of has to be, because you have to take into account it, right? I mean, you know, an interesting question now is once you start thinking about the idea of coherent feedback controller memories, can you do something outside the stabilizer formalism, right? Because now, you know, the different quadratures of a probe field can carry non-commuting observables, so maybe you can get rid of this notion that the stabilizer generators have to commute. Maybe there'll be different kinds of codes that you could work with, I don't know. That's something that we're a little bit interested in. But yeah, you know, so at least in terms of everything that I've presented here, the idea is not that we have some magic coherent quantum advantage necessarily. It really, in terms of what you're doing with the feedback, I think it's really just that in terms of size, weight, and power, you know, if it's just as easy to think about things in a coherent fashion, it's just it's more scalable.
Yeah, I just like to add to that that for us in circuit theory, measurement is by far the hardest thing to do, both technologically and in terms of actually making the fidelity, like going from quantum to classical at high fidelity is very, very, very hard. So not dealing with that sounds great.
So you know, a lot of the spirit is really, you take the key ideas that you get from thinking very abstractly about classical or quantum information processing, you try to push those ideas as close to the raw component physics as you can. Mm-hmm. And then coherent feedback emerges just as kind of a natural way to do that.
Just one point back to Ivan's question, I guess. So, it's still possible to maybe do a measurement feedback design because when you're using the measurement feedback, doing control theory, in a sense you're pushing it into a classical problem, like controlling a Marshall equation, for example, or a stochastic Marshall equation. So conceptually that's a relatively understood thing to do, whereas trying to work out optimal designs, put it coherently, is complicated. So even if you do a classical design, you still might wish to implement it fully optically. So there's a difference between the design process and the implementation stage.
I guess part of my question is trying to understand a little bit and probe a little bit about what, in principle, there's a question of what's achievable technologically, what's hard and what's easy, but if there are some goalposts, say, oh, measurement would help us in some very fundamental way, and so we really should push our amplifiers or what have you, because there's a payoff at it. And if there's no payoff, you say, well, no, you know, really, I can achieve the same things purely coherently, so, you know, that, it's not clear to me.
Yeah, I would just offer my own speculation about that. You know, having been part of a community that's thought very hard for a long time about interesting and unique things you can do with measurement feedback control, I don't really know that we've found any killer application.
I agree. Right?
So it's hard to say that there's a real motivation for carrying all that extra
error correction is more.
Yeah, maybe. Although, you know, if you can do all that in an embedded, coherent way, that's
right. Really, that's really my question. I'm not sure you can. If you could, then maybe. But if measurement is essential for it, then we should really think about it.
The little addendum to my talk here is I think even before you think about fancy things like quantum error correction, mm-hmm. like computers think about size, weight, power for things like avionic signal processing or sensor networks. I think there's a reason to think seriously about coherent feedback kinds of models, just because of the size, weight, power stuff.
So is it known whether or not you can do error correction all coherently, in the sense that you've been talking about here?
There's no reason to believe that network that I put up won't work. But that's not, I mean, it depends on what you mean by coherently. Right? I mean, that's using optical fields.
I guess what I mean is without projecting anything.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. You can.
But you still need some sort of irreversibility to dump into the out some way.
I mean, the thing, if you look at that design, there are probe fields that just go out right. The ports and disappear, right. And that makes it disappear. I mean, that doesn't affect your projection.
Yeah, but there's also a question of time scales. I mean, there's, in principle, you can map, you can coherentize the quantum circuit, but then there's the performance issue and what aspects of performance would be tied to measurement and what not.
I think another really interesting thing, right, about that coherent feedback model, I mean, and this is not a fundamental thing, but in a model like this, right, it's very easy to now go in and modify your VHDL code, insert propagation losses all over the place. You find that it's very easy in this model to now add diff flip errors in the controllers and to investigate the performance of your memory and things like that. So I think in terms of being able to look at your model and understand quantitatively what's happening with a much wider range of different kind of error models, I think this is an interesting thing.
Well, huh? You have a question?
Yeah, I need to respond to your question. I think the fundamental advantage to this stuff is not so much measurement versus coherent feedback, but the fact that you have traveling field, which allow you to have non-local comparison of syndromes.
There's a kind of irreversibility here in the sense of dumping,
right.
Because yeah.
And that's really hard to do when you try to do cooling of a lattice or something like that, which is what I was presenting.
There's some other funny things too that we've been finding, like when you go to something like actual different short codes, there are funny subsystem properties of codes that you can take advantage of where, you know, if you route your probe field around your qubits in a certain order, you find that, you know, as would happen in any circuit, if you have losses on the probe fields during the syndrome measurement, they can do very bad things, like introduce correlated multibody errors. But here, you get kind of for free that just, if you route them in a smart way that takes advantage of the subsystem structure, you can remove that susceptibility, kind of in a way that Alfredson and Cross have talked about. So this propagating field thing is, there's all kinds of funny ways that you can, you know, not at a fundamental level, but just at a practical level, there are things that you can take advantage of.
Questions?
Oh, Josh.
So I'm a little bit confused by, I guess you and Matt sort of touched on this point that you didn't think quantum circuits were analogous to classical circuits. And sort of, I don't know, the way I think about it is, so if you work in the computational basis, for example, then and don't think about reversible logic, then you would say that like an X gate is like exactly and not deep, right? Is that fair to say? So I'd say that's an exact mapping.
Yes, and no, so sometimes when I give a talk, I start out with this, sorry.
Well, okay, just let me, so then when we go to reversible logic, we know things like classical reversible logic, you know, like, it's just a classical complete set of gates would be a NAND gate, fan in, fan out, we don't have fan in, fan out in quantum. So we have to go to the Fredkin gate, right, which is a controlled switch. So once you go to that classical and draw it like that, aren't they identical? I mean.
So it depends on what you're talking about, right? So I love to start talks with this diagram. This is, again, just something I downloaded off the web. It's from the MIT Open Courseware stuff. And it's just, you know, an overview slide for the electrical engineering program at MIT. I didn't go to MIT, but I'm sure some of the people here in the room did. And kind of what the idea is just saying, in the hierarchy of layers of abstraction in engineering, and this is really a key concept, right, the idea is that there's fundamental physics, you know, there's just the pure data of what you observe in experiments. You can summarize those in physical models like Maxwell's laws, but you then go to lump circuit kinds of abstractions, then you have amplifier abstractions, you can then go analog or digital.
So
the idea is that, you know, these are really fundamental. These kinds of abstractions are completely super fundamental in modern engineering.
I agree.
And the funny thing about all of this stuff, right, is that quantum information, even though, you know, we don't really understand what's going on here, I would say, right? The transition from lump circuit elements to amplifiers, in the quantum world, I don't think we completely understand that yet. And yet, quantum information decided to jump in down here.
Well, I think that labeling's wrong. I think actually our abstraction's at the gate level. I mean,
the gate level is like a NAND gate, but it's a continuous time thing. But a real gate is not clocked, and it's not digital. It's like a transistor. Like a transistor is a real gate.
Quantum circuits are like assembly language, right?
Yeah, quantum circuits are, it's a pseudocode.
It might be somewhere in between those two levels, but the other point I'd make is that, you know, that's part of the power, right, is that we don't have to, just as when you draw a transistor or you draw a NAND gate, you don't worry about whether that's made in gallium arsenide or silicon or whether someone builds a quirky water system, right, that's
at that level. So why do we have abstraction in classical engineering? Right? Really what it is you trade off raw performance for designability. That's what abstraction is in classical engineering. Right? Now the problem is, I think if we talk about quantum technology or any kind of nanoscale technology, we don't have raw performance to burn.
Sure.
Okay? So we can't give up raw performance for the sake of simple abstractions like qubits and controlled NOT gates.
At some point, you've got to go down to the actual hardware.
I think we're never going to design anything complicated if we don't have some abstractions.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of reason to believe that in the quantum world and the nano world, we need different abstractions to allow us to design complicated systems, giving up less performance. And even before you talk about quantum, if you just want to talk about circuit design that's power aware, you already need to redraw what the abstractions really are. And that's, I think, the super fundamental challenge that we have in the field.
Question in response. It's a brief comment, which is just that when we talk about circuits and possible electrical systems, we mean channels in a quantum sense. So a quantum channel is the word you're looking for to describe something that looks like an electrical circuit. Anyway.
I guess I was taking that concern.
I understand that. Yeah. I'm just saying that it's a bad use of language in our work. So,
yeah.
I'm not very receptive to that. But the question, so all this is wonderful, but I'm a little surprised in the language of feedback, coherent feedback, that things like the ring laser gyro don't appear more prominently. So any comment as to why we haven't talked about that yet at this conference?
It's a valid point. Anytime we draw one of these coherent feedback things, it's some interferometer.
Sure.
Right. And you can just notice that, like signal recycling and LIGO, these things are all, people have thought about optical feedback before. If you want to stabilize a diode laser, right, you're probably using some sort of optical feedback. So in a sense, there's nothing new about the idea of making feedback loops with light. Right? The new idea is simply to think about how you analyze, synthesize, model such things when you're really interested in a quantum optical model underneath. And, as people have pointed out, in prior work, people have thought about coherent feedback in a quantum setting. So we just, want to kind of pull that up to a general level of theory where there's simple to use methodology of how you do the design and some heuristics for how you try to make large scale circuits that do what you want.
So, but I think there's a physical aspect to it, and that is the fluctuations you're trying to control are at the quantum end. They're in what we used to call the small system size limit, mm-hmm. where the switching mm-hmm. between your bistable branches is not thermal, mm-hmm. it's quantum. And so it looks exactly the same, or pretty much the same as what you do if it was thermally mm-hmm. Driven, and we're trying to stabilize that, but it's driven by quantum noise.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention that the state machine is a bit more complex.
Oh, yes, that's an issue.
In the ring laser gyro, you have a mean field description, mm-hmm. which allows you to represent the state classically.
Yeah. You can take any of these models and just put brackets around everything and end up with a mean field model of your circuit.
Yeah,
but what's nice is you don't have to do that. Yeah.
A reminder, I have a question about that bistability and the experiments. So it sounded like you actually sort of empirically found the right time scale. But can you...
Oh yeah, you can count. Yeah.
So you don't have to fool around and determine it, but you can actually predict it ahead of time.
You can predict ahead of time. I think I didn't include the data on this slide, but in that paper, there's a G2 of tau curve, which shows you the time scale of that switching, and
it's what you would expect.
So we don't have an analytic way of understanding it, but if you do a master case, you get the same time scale.
All right, so you can do some calculation.
A numerical solution.
You can numerically determine what you expect it to be.
In the case of optical bistability, switching times in the quantum domain can be worked out pretty well.
And so is there a simple, and the second question, is there a simple way to understand that time scale in terms of the energy levels and the basic components?
This data and the experiment is more or less in the absorptive, it's in a mixed absorptive dispersive, but mostly absorptive regime of the bistability. And there I would have a little bit more trouble coming up with a good description. Here in the dispersive bistability, it's a little bit easier to understand what's happening so this is a Q function for the steady state intercavity field. And so you see it's bimodal, just representing those two things. Right? And you can just sort of see that, since this thing is operating as a Kernon-linearity, the basic idea of it is if I'm in the low power state, there's hardly any photons in the cavity, so the Kernon-linearity doesn't really introduce anything in terms of an effective detuning for the cavity, and I'm driving the cavity off-resonant. So that's a self-sustaining situation. In the high power state, I'm still driving it off-resonance, but if there are a large number of photons in the cavity, that produces a Kerr shift, which moves the resonance over to where I'm driving it. So that's also stable. And so now, why do you have switching? Well, imagine I start out in this low power state. Well, it's not an exact photon number in the low power state, right? There's a quantum uncertainty about that photon number, which has a little tail, which actually overlaps here. And so eventually, that little tail of the distribution actually gives you real photons in the cavity, and you jump up, and vice versa. So yeah, in the dispersive limit, it's easy because the only quantum system is the field. in the absorptive bistability model with the atom, which is what the data is, it's more complicated because both the field and the atom are quantized, and I think it's harder to tell a simple story. But in this kind of picture, I think it's, you know, it's really just a photon of uncertainty, which makes it so that your two logical states kind of overlap a little.
And from that overlap, you could maybe get a simple estimate of the time scale?
There are techniques going back to Kramers and tunneling and classical bistability that you can apply here. Yeah.
So what would the notion of the barrier, what would the meaning of the barrier be?
In the case of dispersive bistability, the Fokker-Planck equation is safe at the Q functional, and not sure about the Q function, but they satisfy potential conditions, so you can define dissipative potentials for these systems and calculate barrier heights. So the barrier height determines the relative height of those two steady state peaks that we've been in.
But you can then construct from this description of the
Ancient history.
But actually, we've just cranked it all up again for the case of CircuitQED, where they can see, they have huge current nonlinearities. And so we have this collaboration with Peter Delsing and Chalmers, where they see switching between these bistable points. A little bit more complicated because there's a parametric term in there as well, but nonetheless, you can still calculate the switching times at low temperature. In fact, at zero temperature, extremely accurate. Okay, so I think we're finished.